together.
Thanks for listening to the KC Morning Show.
The media would like you to believe the story that millennials are a bunch of lazy narcissists.
Do I think we're lazy? No. Do we care about the things that everyone thinks we should care about? No.
There are four basic types of generations. These repeating archetypes take place within four turnings.
Four generations is about 80 years, and about every 80 years, there's a major crisis.
We've entered another one of these fourth turning eras.
Biggest wildfire.
We are in a do or die situation where we have to choose right now. What are we going to do?
It's time to set the record straight about our generation.
Water is not a privilege. Clean water is a right.
If you want to change a broken system, you have to change the structure of that system.
A record number of millennials are running for office.
Millennials are beginning to move into real leadership roles for the first time.
Our system is not designed for working class Americans to hold office.
Look at anything we care about, whether it's gender equality, racial equality, or indigenous rights, clean water, access to good education. Climate change touches all of them.
The mission of our generation is simple. Use every tool we have, including our political system, to fix our climate and save our future.
This is about the entire future of humanity and Mother Earth.
This is not radical stuff. This is all within reach.
The hero of our generation is our generation.
This whole revolution, we will make the impossible possible. No matter our race, our gender, our sexual orientation, our religion, we're fighting for an America as good as its promise.
January 11th, 1970, victory belonged to Hank Stram and his Kansas City Chiefs.
TV9 News Special Report, close up the flood of 77.
From the Kemper Arena in Kansas City, Missouri, it's Milwaukee Bucks against the Kansas City Kings.
Now Kansas Cityans must decide what happens next. What is to follow the city's Holy Week riots?
I am here at the American Royal World Series of Barbecue.
Daryl Motley awaits, and the Kansas City Royals are world champions.
Professor Harvey K., my brother. He is the good professor. The good professor emeritus over at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. And y'all know what we do. Tuesdays, every Tuesdays on your KC Morning Show, my brother and I, we take back America, reclaiming that radical, progressive history of America. It's a beautiful promise. We've always had it. We think that we should get back to it. And now, Professor K, having moved your intro aside, my friends, we have a guest on the show joining us as we take back America, Rosa Calderon. You may have actually already seen and heard parts of her story. She was featured on Knock Down the House, that documentary, as well as Revolution Generation. But not only that, she ran for Congress. She is the executive director of Future Gen Pack. She's a refugee, a geoscientist. She's an original OG Justice Dems alum. And on top of that, she's a progressive, she's a patriot, and she's a friend. My friends, welcome to the show, Rosa Calderon. Are you ready to take back America with us?
Yes, I am. We're here. We're here for it.
We've all been tasked post-election. You know, what's our plan? How are we going to make sure that we are still 10 toes down, but also we have to recognize where we are? We need to get our people activated, empowered. And Professor K has
been making it his mission to make the intros. And I think that is just so, so important, especially today. We're recording this as we pull back the curtain on January 6th, the anniversary, the dark anniversary of what was an insurrection, a coup on our Constitution at our nation's capital. Professor K, we talked about this a few years ago. The unfortunate coincidence that that dark day was on the anniversary of President Franklin Roosevelt's For Freedom speech. But it's also some poetry there in the fact that we take back America, we reclaim history. Even on our darkest days, we have a history to go back to that can ensure that J6 of it all doesn't have to happen again. If we can fulfill on our promises of the Four Freedoms, we don't have to worry about a coup on our Constitution. So with that, Professor K, why don't you make some remarks on this anniversary and then also maybe explain how you all met, you and Rosa.
Okay, well, I'll start by saying, I mean, I'd love to start with the Rosa and Harvey question, but let me start with the FDR stuff. January 6th, 1941, the United States was not yet involved in World War II that was already underway both in East Asia and in Europe. But FDR was committed to making sure that the last of the democracies in Europe, specifically the British Isles, United Kingdom, if you prefer, England, Scotland, Wales, were not going to fall to fascism, to Nazism. And he was determined to create what was known as the Lend-Lease Act, the Lend-Lease Program, where the United States, with its massive industrial complex, would provide the materials of war and the supplies needed for Britain and its allies around the world to survive the Nazi onslaught. But the other thing is that FDR knew very well, okay, there was more than enough intelligence to know that the idea that the United States could remain out of the war at that time, however much Americans didn't want to get into it, however much they might not have wanted to get into it, there was no way that the United States was going to remain, in quotes, immune or removed from the war. In good part, because the Atlantic is our eastern boundary and the Pacific is our western, and you have out to the west, of course, Japan, and to the east, you had Europe. So, okay, even more important than that is that FDR knew Hitler's war plans. They had more than enough intelligence to know that Hitler was expecting at some point to make an attack on the United States. In fact, they actually expected the attack to come from West Africa. Everyone knows, well, sorry, people who study history know that Hitler sought to take North Africa, in spite of the fact that most of it's desert, because of oil reserves. He needed those oil reserves. But it's often forgotten that he had intended that West Africa could be a launching pad for an attack on the Americas. And in certain cases, such as Brazil, one could not even know if perhaps Brazil might not go fascist. The Germans were spending a lot of money in Mexico, basically, to try to create allies on the ground there. John Steinbeck, who was living in Mexico at the time, when he came back to the United States, actually went to see FDR, and given his fame and the importance of the book, The Grapes of Wrath, and the ensuing movie, he met with FDR to urge him to start thinking about how to counter the German monies that are flowing into Mexico in hopes of buying people off in favor of fascism. So FDR knew that. And the State of the Union address of 1941 became the moment when FDR, even though he doesn't say we're going to go to war, what he does say is, they're not going to tell us, the likes of the dictators are not going to tell us when they're going to attack. And we have to be prepared. And one way to be prepared is we provide, again, a Lend-Lease program to the Brits. But also, we have to make sure that we're ready here at home. And as a consequence, by the way, they launched civil defense programs and so on and so forth. But also, he said to Americans, first of all, that we are not going to give up the progress we've made in the course of the New Deal. I know you don't want to, and I have no intention of doing so. And actually, he starts to lay out a vision, starts to lay out a vision of the kinds of things Americans should feel remain their rights. He lays out the imperative of, he says, the basic things expected by our people of their political and economic systems are simple. They are equality of opportunity for youth and for others, jobs for those who can work, security for those who need it, the ending of special privilege for the few, the preservation of civil liberties for all, the enjoyment of the fruits of scientific progress, and a wider and constantly rising standard of living. And let's be clear, let's not fantasize about the past, okay? The fact is that FDR would make certain critical mistakes, tragic mistakes, in failing to address injustices such as he was compelled, given the state of the Union, to allow for the creation of a segregated military. And he did not have it within his power to truly address the apartheid that existed in the South, okay? But it is the case, in the course of the war, he did make efforts, seriously make efforts, by way of agencies and enactments and executive orders to address certain kinds of inequalities. The other thing that, having declared what you will hear as the Four Freedoms, he allowed himself to be persuaded by California political types and military leaders to actually create, in the course of 1942, a program in which Japanese Americans were interned in camps in the West and in the South. And I'll just note to everyone, I think I've said this before when we've talked about this, Hartzell, my very best friend for many years, a bit older than I and now passed away, was born in one of those camps in Arkansas while his father was serving in the U.S. military. They could enlist, they could be subject to the draft, and many, many did. There were those who did not. Their numbers were small compared to the vast numbers that did actually serve. Okay, having said that, and the third mistake, one of these long-standing historical debates as to whether or not he could have done more for Jewish refugees trying to escape Hitler's Germany that eventually became the Holocaust. And I don't want to get into that, but those were the three tragedies: the persistence of Jim Crow in the South and the creation of a segregated military, the creation of internment camps, and last but not least, of course, the failure to enable more Jewish refugees to come into this country. Some did, most did not make it. Okay. Having said that, on January 6, 1941, FDR wanted to prepare Americans for the possibility of war and to remind them that preparation for war did not mean putting an end to the New Deal. In fact, just again, a bit of history. In the course of World War II, changes were significant enough, and I won't go through all those right now, but they were significant enough that some historians, and I'm sometimes inclined to do it myself, to refer to the war effort as a third New Deal because of the changes that took place. The fact is that the incomes of working people rose, not simply because there was a demand for their labor, but also because the Roosevelt administration created boards, and the boards set floors to wages. So black women were making more than they had ever made before in the United States. If he could have accomplished it, and this is the second time in the course of his administration, he sought a cap on the wealthy. He wanted to limit the incomes of the rich. He tried to get that in 1934. The way he accomplished it back then is he did increase taxes on the rich. But during World War II, he actually wanted to set a cap, like a dollar amount, you know, beyond which they weren't allowed to make more at the time. That he didn't accomplish, but taxes did go up for what it's worth. So he went before the American people and he gave the State of the Union address in which he warned of what might be coming. But then he said it towards the end, when he sort of says these are the kinds of things Americans expect to continue and to be pursued. He then says, in the future days, which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. And I won't read the full paragraphs, but I will speak the key words. The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want everywhere in the world. The fourth is freedom from fear anywhere in the world. Now, I have to say that he then goes on and said that is no vision of a distant millennium. It is a definite basis for a kind of world attainable in our own time and generation. That kind of world is the very antithesis of the so-called new order of tyranny, which the dictators seek to create with the crash of a bomb. The other thing I would point out is that he meant this. I mean, he shocks some of his members of his own staff and cabinet. They said, is he serious? Everywhere in the world kind of thing? Yes, he means it. This is a pursuit. Those words were significant, and they really did in many ways reflect what the New Deal and the efforts of the 30s were about. And also, which we'll probably get to, Hartzell, in a couple of weeks. Wait, that's only 5 days away. On January 11th, 3 years later, in 1944, is when he pronounces the vision of an economic bill of rights for all Americans. So in some ways, he offers this, which is global in almost in its vision. And then he will go on late in the war to tell Americans, you know, I think it's time we recognize that we already kind of accept that the idea now is to pursue an economic bill of rights. So I'll leave it at that for now.
Rosa, on the equal anniversaries of such a dark day, but then also such a day of promise and vision, what are you thinking of today on January 6th?
Thank you. Well, I'm just going to piggyback on what Harvey said. When I think about that speech and the four freedoms that he added to the speech overall, that message spread wildly across the world before it took off in the US. And one of the things that they did was essentially start a propaganda campaign, talk about this issue over years. And that, I think, is what led to the creation of the Economic Bill of Rights, because it took that long to get that message to the masses. You know, one of the things that we still forget is that we are the government. And that was one of the things that they were trying to make everyone essentially be responsible and be part of the social contract that as citizens and as our managing government, you could say, have. And that is a social contract that today has been broken. I think that the parallels that from everything that FDR spoke in that speech to today are uncanny. I really see the loss of hope, the loss of the freedom of expression, freedom of religion, and that freedom of fear, you know, to live in a world where you are able to speak your mind and not be afraid of the repercussions. And I think that all of those things are in danger. Additionally, we are in this precipice of war, and the US, whether we like to admit it or not, we are very engaged in these proxy wars. And it's one of those moments now to rebuild that social contract. We have a 4-point blueprint, and then even after that, the Economic Bill of Rights. And we can really start off where he left off. And I think that today is probably the moment to address what does the American dream really mean? And what are we going to be doing as citizens ourselves to make sure that we can deliver on those promises? As a refugee myself, as I mentioned earlier before we started, was that it was something that was really ingrained in me, you know, as a new American. The idea that the promise that anyone who works hard can succeed no matter where you came from. But now that promise is now more of an idea. And at the time when I believe FDR gave this speech, about 1/3 of Americans lived in poverty and didn't really have the ability to have like stable housing and food. Today, we're seeing that number in the 3/4 of Americans. 70% of Americans are living under $30,000 a year. And we are now in a point where we can ask ourselves, is this the society that I want to live in? Am I responsible for anything that's happening? And am I comfortable with the oppression that we're living and seeing? And what am I going to do to change that? So I think that given everything that's been happening, at least for the last 9 years since Trump started running for office, and a lot of the questions that we have as to what it means to build a prosperous society, these are all questions that remain to be answered. And I think that the messenger is going to be one of the most important people, you know, in some of this. We've had great messengers like Bernie Sanders, who brought up the 21st Century Bill of Rights during his campaign. And it will take time. But I think that we have to make an actual effort to speak to everyone about this and be as inclusive as possible. One of the things that I mentioned was the campaigns that they ran, the Norman Rockwell images. They would run these images and they would depict the regular mechanic, the regular household being part of the campaign itself. And I think that the other part of that was unions. And we're at that moment now where people are wondering, where is my job security? How can I afford eggs to feed my family? And we do have to bring everyone back in and reclaim the American dream, demand that these four principles are followed. And then we just have to set up a plan of action through those steps in the Bill of Rights.
Harvey and I, this project, you know, Taking Back America, I draw my cues from Frederick Douglass. When we talk about reclaiming or taking back that American dream, that American promise, the story, how can we reclaim that as progressives in a way that doesn't just sound like, you know, we're being star-spangled awesome. Like, no, this is a real thing that we do need to take back and then use to propel us, because we would argue that that promise, that story has always been progressive. It's always been to the left. How do you double down and make that argument resonate for folks who are rightfully a little bit jaded?
Well, I think right now with what just happened with the United Healthcare CEO, a lot of people are addressing the fact that we are now in a corporatocracy rather than a direct democracy or even a representative democracy, in particular because our representatives are now serving additional interests rather than the interests of citizens. The reason why I brought up the Rockwell paintings was because it was a way to unify essentially the working class, the masses. We are the economy here. I think that an economic bill of rights is the way to essentially unify everyone because we do. We all believe it, whether it's a possibility now, but it's definitely an ideal in all Americans that we do believe in the American dream. We do believe that if we work hard, that we can get ahead. So we have to essentially create these economic opportunities so that that dream can be real rather than these corporations who now dictate what we do, what we buy, what we eat, if we're going to get surgery, if we're going to live tomorrow, if the $20,000 to $200,000 that we've been paying in premiums over decades is going to be there for me when I'm diagnosed with something and I need healthcare. And that is the struggle of many Americans. It's probably why there was not a backlash, you could say, to the assassination of the CEO, because so many of us have felt that pain. We have lost so many. We have lost so much. And I think that the person who is going to rebuild this nation, or the party that's going to rebuild this nation, is going to have a message for the people, for the working class, for prosperity that we don't have today. And it's going to have to be bold enough to pull back on the corporatocracy that we're seeing today, even more visible today with the cabinet that President Trump-elect is going to be swearing in the next few weeks. It is a scary time. And I think that for us to take action, we need to start talking about our economic prosperity.
Harvey, I'm sorry. I got plenty of stuff for you, but I'm fascinated right now.
That's fine.
That strategy, you know, because there's so many pundits who went straight to mainstream media to say how much this was an indictment on pronouns, or that the left lost this election, knowing well enough that there was no material message that was being presented. But unfortunately, I think a lot of the takeaway is this like anti-identity angle. And I think it's just a missed opportunity, or at least what I've been telling people. I think that we are shadow boxing a right-wing construction. I think we're trying to have an answer to something that is not real. I believe the trans lives matter, right? That's my identity politics. Well, if I'm someone on the left, I say, yes, I believe that my trans brothers and sisters deserve gender-affirming care, but that's also an argument for universal health care. You know, but there are the folks on TV that would tell me that I need to just make just an economic argument or just a cultural argument, and it's just wasting an opportunity. Yeah?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that is happening, and we have, as at least on the left side, been horrible at, is the messaging war. We've essentially lost it. And for the last year, I've been trying to gather everyone, leaders from organizations, representatives. I'm trying to build a coalition so that we can address this issue. There was one representative in Congress now, is the youngest Gen Z member of Congress, Maxwell Frost. We were looking for candidates to support in the 2022 election. There was a speech he gave about love. And he said, if you love your brother, then you want them to have health care. If you love your neighbor, you want them to have clean air to breathe. And it kind of removed the identity from it, and it became a very human aspect. And that, I think, is what we have essentially removed from it. Because like you said, you know, I believe in trans rights. I believe that my brother and sister should have access to the medical care they need. But it is an argument about healthcare. I also believe that people who maybe are diagnosed with a rare form of cancer or have the breakthrough innovative research that's going to save their lives. I don't think that that should be reserved for the few. It should be for the many. We are the government, as I had mentioned earlier. We actually pay into this pool to do research. And then that research is essentially monopolized by corporations and then only given to the people who can now afford it, even though we technically all paid into it. So we need to get back to the point where we understand that if it's our money, it's ours to play with as well. It is not, and it should not be reserved for just a few. The other part of that is, as I was mentioning, I've been calling everyone. I think that one of the most successful things that they did was essentially run a campaign on the messages. I think in your book, Harvey, you mentioned that there was a point where the four freedoms really weren't taking off and they were about to abandon it. That's when they launched this propaganda campaign, essentially. But we have seen that some propaganda campaigns have been very effective, including like Smokey the Bear. The Ad Council was also brought around that time as well to essentially talk about what society we want to live in, right? And those things have proven to create a unity for us to create like that industrial labor market during the war that gave so many people opportunities. And we can do that again with Green New Deals. We can do that through infrastructure. We can do that through jobs. You know, we are at a point now, even through our environment, that we're at a mitigation point in many, many areas. So that can create jobs. And it's not a problem of being Black or being Hispanic. There are white people, there are Indian people, South Asian people that live in these communities as well. So it is going to have to be a collective effort. That is one word that I think has been removed from most of our conversations and definitely wasn't really there even for the last presidential election. And collectively, we need to talk about unions and making sure that we have protections for our jobs, that we are able to negotiate our salaries and not do that in fear. And so I think that those are going to be part of the things that we're going to have to do to get the message across. And that is going to have to be done by telling stories, humanizing the struggle, because it's all of our struggles. None of us are exempt from it.
And I'm so happy you brought up propaganda, because I don't think they teach us well enough in high school that that's not necessarily a malicious term when you say propaganda. And Harvey, how many years now, brother, have we said that the left, progressive, we have to reclaim pop culture? And Rosa, you are an excellent example of this. Millions of eyes saw your story, saw your run for office because of those documentaries. That's incredible. I mean, we were introduced to Cori Bush and AOC for the first times in some of these viewings. Pop culture, we gotta take that back and reclaim it with stories. Asking our folks, what is the world you want to live in? What is the world you want to build? And then just hit record and let them go.
Right, right. Absolutely. And in fact, in one of those documentaries, The Revolution Generation, they feature my story along with AOC because we had come from backgrounds where women like us were not meant to run. What it took out of my family and myself to run, what it took out of her to run, politics is not a sport for the average man. Let's put it that way. You have to be independently wealthy to do that. And in that documentary itself, they do talk about the four revolutions. Every generation will go through their own struggle. And there's a quote, if you don't mind, I read this. It's from
absolutely.
Harvey's book, actually, the FDR on Democracy. And he says, there is a mysterious cycle in human events. To some generation, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny. And essentially what I think he meant by this is those revolutions, right? During the early 1900s, you see this formation of essentially the first Progressive Party, the 1920s. Then you see, you know, FDR coming in with the New Deal in 36. And then again, these principles in 41, the war that kind of leads us into the Economic Bill of Rights. And then we see this very prosperous era all the way through about the mid 80s. And then you can see this break from labor, where the power of labor is now unbalanced. They start attacking unions. They start essentially creating individualism rather than a collective. Why should you get paid the same that Tom is getting paid when Tom is taking a break every 5 minutes for a cigarette? You know, and so it created a scarcity mentality, a me versus them versus a not me, us. And I keep bringing up quotes from people who've ran, who've inspired me. One of the things that I still say to this day from Bernie Sanders' 2020 campaign is fight for someone you don't know, because that person is probably going through some struggles that I've gone through. And for me, when I think of the struggles that I've gone through after, you know, the 2008 recession, I don't want anyone else to ever go through that. So that's the society I want to build. I don't want anyone to lose their home. I want everyone to have security. I want everyone to be able to rebuild their lives. And so I think that when we're asking that question, we really should be asking people, like, what do you see as a vision, as a collective for everyone, not just the individuals? So I think that that framework itself is a deviation from identity politics, which we have been, you know, at least on the left, pushing for so long. But bringing everyone back in and giving everyone that strength in a collective to be able to bargain for their rights and the labor that putting out is going to be really where we need to start.
Well, guess what? I confess that I didn't even know about this documentary. While you were speaking, I could hear it all, obviously. I went to see where it is that I could gain access to it, and I see that there are YouTube and a lot of other places. So I've already added it to the watch list at every one of the places that I have some kind of access to. I guarantee you I will watch it. What do I think about all this? One part of me, not just the historian, but the 75-year-old professor, knows how dramatic the changes have been since I was in college. However, this same person and political historian and activist knows that the dynamic that had begun really in the 1930s, and that was continued, you know, a continued struggle through the 40s, the 50s, and through the 60s, really did confront massive, for lack of a better word, class war opposition in the course of the 70s and since. So we've seen 50 years of war on the democratic achievements of what we often think of as two generations, the generation of the 30s and 40s and the generation of the 1960s. What have we seen? Well, we've seen the Voting Rights Act basically, you know, severed. We've seen women's rights as secured at least by way of a Supreme Court decision, the right to choose, no longer the law of the land, but dependent on states' rights. Talk about irony, okay? The gross inequalities in very basic material sense that has prevailed or come to prevail since the 1970s, that alone should have led to far more dynamic action. But the problem is, let's be clear about it, the problem is they targeted labor. When I say the forces that were pursuing class war from above, they targeted labor. They divided people over questions of race and gender and gender identities. I mean, this has been a really long-standing culture war, class war, however you want to pursue it. But it, I mean, it is the case. One of my fears is, of course, that we have forgotten as a people, we have forgotten the degree to which we are capable of actually shared, collective, dynamic, progressive slash radical action. In other words, how many Americans will tell you that based on what we saw happen, whether it's the revolution, the Civil War and after, or for that matter, most significantly, the 1930s and 40s, which we still can enjoy some of the benefits of, how many can tell you that that's proof that it didn't have to be this way? Okay. So one of the reasons that we've been taking back America on these Tuesday occasions is because we're trying to remind people of the words spoken that inspired generations to carry out the kinds of radical actions that we now know we need again. And, you know, I have this sort of, you know, call it a romantic notion of things. I believe that most Americans, even the ones who've turned to the dark side, you know, the Trump MAGA forces, many of them still carry a sort of fundamental notion of what it means to be an American, which we on the left failed to cultivate. We have also contributed to this debacle in a significant way. For example, And we can take this up any day of the week, Hartzell, if you want. Criticism is essential. Critique is an essential act. Who the hell wants to put up with the way things are? But critique on its own is absolutely insufficient to create a movement. It can create an anger. It can create an event. It cannot create a movement. A movement requires a vision. And the vision can readily be drawn from American experience. Far too often, the left found itself in a position of knee-jerking in their response to these forces of capital and the right, and as a consequence, literally set themselves up for the attacks that later came to prevail. This is my view. I don't expect anyone else to subscribe to it, but that view is predicated on the fact that I do believe there's a fundamental notion of what it means to be an American and what is required to create a decent American society.
Absolutely. You know, when we do talk about cleaning our house, right? I am not going to go to Harvey's house and rearrange his furniture. I'm going to rearrange the furniture in my house if I want it to be feng shui. It's my obligation, right? So yes, the American dream, the American promise is something that I am going to demand that it's not just there for me, but it's there for my daughter. I think that in a way, I already am the American dream. I came to the U.S. as a refugee. I was able to study in the U.S. I was able to go to college. I was able to start a business. And in a way, now I am involved in politics because I am part of the government. We are the people, right? So that to me is the American dream. I want to make sure those opportunities are also there for my daughter. I don't want her to be drowning in school debt. You know, those are not the promises that we make. And I'm going to hold them to it, right? So I think that right now when we talk about the radical right, even the slogan of the Make America Great, it's a borrowed slogan from the 80s. It's a borrowed slogan from Reagan. But what does it actually mean? And I think that that's the other part that we are not as Democrats painting a very definitive image of what that could be. And in a way, we're also not asking or caring what other people are telling us their struggles are. The economy was definitely not at the forefront of the last presidential election on the Democratic ticket. It was something that they just tried to brush over. But I do have family members who, again, themselves left El Salvador during the Civil War and have come to the U.S. and now are citizens and can vote. Even some of them were worried about the price of eggs. But those are all things that we have essentially pushed to the wayside. The other part of this is, again, when it comes to corporations and middle America, one of the things that Trump has always talked about fighting for is our farmers, right? But farmers are now in debt, in so much debt, because corporations essentially control everything on their land, from the seeds to the tractors. And one of the biggest issues that they're dealing with as well is the right to repair. Something that I've spoken to with unions many times. But that doesn't just affect farmers anymore. That affects the food and how it gets to your table. That also affects the way that you're able to repair your cell phone. Before, we were able to just take the battery out, switch little things out like that. We're talking about even the smallest things. You driving on the road and getting in a vehicle accident, and if you just have liability, now these repairs are 3 to 4 times what they were before because of sensors, because of the right to repair. Some of these major, major vehicle manufacturers are creating specialized tools that only they can use, and you have to take it to the dealership, essentially pushing out your regular mechanic auto shop out of business. So a lot of the times, I mean, if your insurance isn't going to cover it because they're calling it a total, the business is losing on the actual transaction of the money. Now, just the person who's insured is getting a check and they're using that check to go buy again a new vehicle from a new corporation. Aside from that, we're seeing it coming together. You know, Nissan and Honda, I believe, are trying to do a merger. And we're going to start seeing a few of these vehicle manufacturers start trying to merge as well, because they're claiming that they're spending too much money on trying to make vehicles greener, you know, electric. But they're going to say that. And this is something that I hope that we remember probably in the next 4 or 5 years as these mandates are passing. That cost is going to be passed on to us. Again, vehicles right now are around, the most affordable is around $30,000 to $40,000. When I purchased my brand new vehicle in 2003, it cost me $9,000. And that was at the dealership. I mean, that's the struggles that Americans are dealing with, and nobody is addressing the right to repair, and it affects so many. That alone could have been an economic message. It creates a very clear enemy, right? The corporations really are the bad guy. It's not the guy that's sitting next to you, not the person who is also struggling to buy eggs. So those are the things that I think we need to really address. And I am a firm believer that media, pop culture, marketing is the way that we're going to essentially let everyone know that we are being taken.
I mean, look how the people have just fought back against right to work. I live in Missouri, Rosa. We expanded minimum wage and we codified abortion. That's a working class message. And right now, Jeff City, they're trying to take away that initiative petition process. Missouri ain't going to vote for Bernie, but you know what they want? They want a couple days off. They want a raise.
I always find it fascinating, just sidebar to that. Florida passed a few years ago. $15 an hour minimum wage in Missouri. I mean, Wisconsin is supposed to be historically a progressive state, and we are so stymied. We are dixified, you might say. Yeah.
The difference in where we are the moment heading into Trump 1 to now heading into Trump 2.0, it feels different, right?
Yeah, I actually feel more hopeful. I already knew the outcome of the election before it happened, so I went to bed early. I mean, I had been making calls for months and people were like, let's just wait to see how the election pans out. And, you know, there's only so much you could do. But the next morning, I woke up to emails, calls, texts. I think that, you know, when Trump won the first time, we saw an enormous movement in America from women for immigrants' rights, for the environment. And there was a massive influx of money just to help us get our message across. And it's the only reason probably why we won in 2020. But since getting into office in 2020, we didn't deliver on many or really any of the promises that got us to the polls. And as essentially somebody who is very active, I encourage everyone to get involved. So when we're thinking about who is the next person that's going to get us across the finish line with that message, it's you, it's your neighbor, it's everybody in your community. It has to be a collective. We do have to, I guess, reprogram everyone to understand that we are the government. The government doesn't exist if we don't give it any validity. So what government are we going to validate? What level of oppression and suppression are we going to sit quietly and stand by, you know, while we are also going through the same struggle? So yeah, when you're talking about class war, that's essentially what we're going through right now. But I am filled with more optimism today than before because people are talking about issues like healthcare. They are talking about the millions of people who have died over that. In the southern states, when we're talking about reproductive rights, it is now a conversation that almost every single state supports in a majority for that to be codified into either their state's constitution or at the federal level. One of the things that I learned when I traveled to Argentina in 2019, as they were also fighting for their right for reproductive rights, was how much they had been inspired by the movement of the 70s here in the US. And I remember when the Supreme Court made their decision and how many calls I got from my friends in Argentina crying and saying, like, we just achieved it here and you've just lost it there. And how backwards that felt. As an American, it felt so backwards that we have inspired so many movements, not just here, but worldwide. This idea of freedom of expression has essentially, you know, caught fire all over the world. And here we're apathetic to it at times. So as much as I am very optimistic about it, I do think that we have to like wake everyone back up and remind them that, like I said, they are the government. So yeah, the right to repair, economic prosperity, this class warfare that we're dealing with, those are all human problems. They're American problems. They're not siloed to one specific demographic. You know, we are all struggling. And the only people that the economy is working for is Wall Street.
Rosa, I told you 30 minutes and here we are. It feels so bad.
You shouldn't feel bad. What you should do is say, Rosa, we'll be having you back.
Rosa, will you come back, my friend? This has just been incredible. I've been fired up, but also I feel like we even got more to do, I think.
We got a lot of scheming to do. I would love to come back.
Before I let you go, though, I do want to give the mic and the floor to you. What are you working on? Where can folks go to support, to donate, future Gen Pack? The floor is yours. Take it away.
Well, thank you. Thank you again, like I said, for having me. And it is an honor again to be speaking about this particular issue with Harvey K. If anybody knows Professor Harvey K., he is the expert on this, on FDR and our four freedoms and our economic liberties and how we're going to get there. He has essentially put forth a blueprint for us to follow. So that is what I'm working on, is building a blueprint for and creating these steps for everyone to replicate from state to state. We don't really have to wait for the federal government to act. If you've seen most of the codifications for women's rights, for reproductive rights, it's been happening at the state level. We don't need to worry about Trump. We just need to mobilize in our own communities. So if you want to support us or the work that we're doing, we're at futuregens.org. You can donate. You can sign up to volunteer. We're a volunteer organization. If you know of a person who's an incredible candidate that needs to be representing their community, submit them and we will try to help them get elected so they can fight for these principles that we're advocating for.
Okay, I'm sorry. I have to hold you for another 5 more minutes because there are folks who are in their car right now interested in running for office or wanting to step into the electoral process. What do you tell them?
It's crazy for sure, but it is the right thing to do. As Harvey mentioned, I ran myself for Congress in 2018, and I ran in a very, very deep red district in California. You know, it's about 60-40. I knew that if I didn't even campaign at all, I would get 38% of the vote if I sat at home all day. But that wasn't enough for me. I needed to make sure that for this period of time, whether it was a year and a half, I had the platform to talk about these issues. And that was more important to me than actually winning the election. Subsequently, I was able to inspire people who ran and eventually won, but it can be done. One of the things that I learned during my campaign was how not to lose again. I lost really hard. I had no clue what I was doing. I didn't have the support. I was just a regular person who, you know, my community nominated and I said, okay, I'll do it. But I had no idea how to fundraise, how to launch a campaign, how to be able to effectively even use the little bit of money that I had, the filing fees, like all of those things were very strange to me. There were strange concepts. But because of that, we put together this organization, Future Generations PAC. And what we do is we teach everyone all those skills. We don't charge our candidates anything. We support them every step of the way. And a lot of it has to do with just giving them the tools. All these other campaigns that have millions of dollars sometimes have that we just don't have access to because consultants cost $10,000, you know, for a phone call. And most regular people don't have a Rolodex where each person they know can give them $5,000 to $6,000. Most of us don't even want to ask our friends for $5 because we know that they're in the same situation that we're in. But if you are ready to affect change, if you think that you have what it takes, because it's very, very tough to run, but we need people who, even in the face of fear, have the courage to stand up and fight for what's right.
Professor Harvey K., before we wrap, closing thoughts, my brother?
I'm going to close with something that happened this morning. You know, I was surfing Blue Sky, Twitter, that kind of stuff. And all of a sudden, this young man followed me on Twitter. Lucas Venturis. I'm reading and it says, candidate for Congress in New York 1. Law student at St. John's, an NYU grad, proud American. Now, New York 1 is the eastern half of Long Island, which I'm assuming is not strong Democratic territory. It's not so far from New York City, but it's not New York City, believe me, at all. So, you know, I think I sent him a salute and he came back and, pardon my ego here, hey, this is really cool and I'm a big fan. People like you are why I decided to run for Congress, to topple the corporate oligarchy in this country and return the power to working people. And I thought, oh, there's a young guy. He's not being deterred by the odds.
Absolutely.
Professor Harvey J.K., where can folks find you on the internet? Plug your handles, my brother.
Okay, so I'm still at Twitter, Harvey J.K., initial J in the middle, but I'm also at Blue Sky. I don't know if I'm in the process of migrating permanently. I don't think so. I want to keep getting pissed off by what I see on Twitter. Okay. And at Blue Sky, I'm Harvey J.K., what is it? Dot B Sky. Social. Dot social.
Rosa, where can folks find you? Rosa Calderon, where can folks get you on the internet? They got questions. They want to shoot you emails, donations. Where can folks go?
So if you want to support our org, futuregens.org. And if you want to reach me, it's just my name, Rosa Calderon, all together at every single handle. Social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. I'm not usually there, but if you message me, I will see it.
You're going to come back, yeah, hopefully. Fingers crossed.
Absolutely, yeah. If I get an invite, I will be here.
We're going to need all the help we can get as we continue Harvey K to take back America. See you next week. Bye.
Listen as your day unfolds. Challenge what the future holds. Try and keep your head up to the sky. Lovers, they may cause you tears. Go ahead, release your fears. Stand up and be counted. Don't be ashamed to cry. You gotta be bad. You gotta be bold. You gotta be wiser. You gotta be hard. You gotta be tough. You gotta be stronger. You gotta be cool. You gotta be calm. You gotta stay together. All I know, all I know, love will save the day. Herald what your mother said. Read the books your father read. Trying to solve the puzzles in your own sweet time. Some may have more cash than you. Others take a different view. My, oh my, yeah. You gotta be bad, you gotta be bold. You gotta be wiser. You gotta be hard, you gotta be tough, you gotta be stronger. You gotta be cool, you gotta be calm, you gotta stay together. All I know, love will save the day. Time asks no questions, it goes on without you. Leaving you behind if you can stand the pace. The world keeps on spinning, can't stop it if you try to. Best part is danger staring you in the face. Remember, listen as your day unfolds. Challenge what the future holds. Try to keep your head up to the sky. Lovers, they may cause you tears. Go ahead, release your fears. My, oh my. You gotta be bad, you gotta be bold, you gotta be wiser. You gotta be hard, you gotta be tough, you gotta be stronger. You gotta be cool, you gotta be calm, you gotta stay together. All I know, love will save the day. You gotta be bad, you gotta be bold, you gotta be wiser. You gotta be hard, you gotta be tough, you gotta be stronger. You gotta be cool, you gotta be calm, you gotta stay together. All I know, love will save the day. Got to be bold, got to be bad, got to be